When I heard about the reason for the delay, I thought of Chardin's remark about our having to eat in order to think. I believe our scheduled subject for this evening is Chardin and appraisal. As we have been doing by way of introduction, it is unlikely that any other name in Europe or America today raises more vocal reaction in religious circles than Teilhard de Chardin. To some, he is a mystic and a saint, indeed the prophet of a new world. To others, he is a fraud and a seducer, and perhaps the greatest single threat to the church in modern times. My purpose will not be to attempt the impossible, certainly not to assume either extreme position. My more modest intention is to try to place Chardin in perspective by pointing out where, somewhere perhaps in the middle, is the true picture of the French Jesuit who was born in France, spent most of his productive years in China, and died in the United States in New York City. The plan is to say something in sequence, though not in the same detail, about Chardin's history and influence, the controversy and some of the reasons why it has been raging around his name, some of the unsolved problems which he has left, and then, at greatest length, what I consider some of his contribution to religious thought. In looking at the history and the influence of Chardin, I prescind from the chronology of his biography to merely mention in context two details in his life that I think can well be taken into account in assessing his writings. First of all, Chardin had begun in France as a lecturer in Paris. He was relieved of his teaching position because it was felt that his ideas on evolution were difficult, if not impossible, to reconcile with the Catholic doctrine on original sin. Some time ago, when I stated this and elaborated on it for an encyclopedia article, the editor wrote three times to make sure that I was stating my facts accurately. Yes, he was relieved of his teaching position because his ideas, from the beginning, were felt somehow irreconcilable with Catholic teaching on man's original condition and fall. The second historical item that I think bears at least mention is the fact that among his extant correspondence is a letter that he wrote to his Jesuit general, Father Jansons, in 1951, where he asked the general to take him for what he was. But before he closed the letter, he insisted there were three dominant ideas that should be taken into account in judging him. The first of these, he said, was the unique significance of man, which he saw and whom he called the spearhead of the universe. The second, that never for a moment did he doubt, or we want anyone else to doubt, his loyalty to the Catholic Church. And secondly, the essential place that he gave the risen Christ as the center and peak of creation. The first item reflects Chardin's controversial attitude from his youngest days in the priesthood. And the second says something about his desire to reconcile his theories with scientific progress on the one hand and the Christian Catholic faith on the other. It might be added that anyone who thinks that Chardin is not controversial does not know Chardin. His current influence is monumental. In terms of his own posthumous books published, republished, translated into some 30 languages, commentaries, an average, I understand, of about 2 a month in English, courses taught and whole institutes built to deal with his thought. Now, something about Chardin as the one who has evoked so much controversy. Whatever else he is controverted. But why? As I see it, at least for me, the basic issue may be simply stated. On the one hand, the Holy See has issued on 2 occasions clear documents warning about the writings of Chardin. In 1952, the Holy Office stated in its monitum, which means warning, that Chardin's works, I quote, abound in such ambiguities and indeed even serious errors as to offend Catholic doctrine, unquote. And most recently in 1967, the newly formed Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith repeated the warning, saying the monitum of 52, quote, is still in effect. That's one side of the picture. Let me say at the outset that I fully accept the judgment of the Holy See. Yet, and this is the problem, such admiration as I have for Chardin does not blind me any more than it blinds his closest friend, Père de Lubac, to Chardin's inadequacies, his limitations, and asserted statements which, taken at their face value, are sometimes irreconcilable with basic Catholic dogma. What are some of these ambiguities and inconsistencies? First, his theory of a complete and universal evolution, unmitigated evolution, which leaves open the question of the unique and individual creation, for example, of each human soul, about which science knows nothing, but which faith teaches the Christian to believe. Secondly, the origin of spirit from matter and the corresponding obscurity of real distinction between that which is material and dimensional and that which is spiritual. Thirdly, the preoccupation with the evolutive process to the obscuration of sin and its need for redemption, that man not only progresses, he also, as we so painfully know from our own experience, also regresses fourthly the postulate of life somehow animating the whole universe fifth the absolute transcendence of God as the only necessary being who existed before the universe was made and who does not need anything he made, as one who stands above and beyond while yet present in the developing universe. And finally, the absolute necessity of grace, which, as Christianity teaches its followers, is supernatural, and which is not so easy to account for where you have a natural, intrinsic evolution for the whole universe. The question then that I've asked myself for over 15 years is how reconcile the admiration that a reader may have for Chardin without denying the problematic issues that he raises. And he does. Here's what I have done with Chardin. This is the first time I've given just this kind of lecture on Chardin, though I do lecture on him. First of all, Chardin the man is not always Chardin the writer. His ideas are not always easy to reconcile with his known deep faith and devotion to the Catholic Church. In other words, his intentions are not always reflected in his ideology. Again, Chardin is nothing if not full of insights and bright illuminations. But even a single word, certainly a sentence or two, carries with it its own logic. As this logic is pursued, the systematic and now developing Teilhardism is notoriously less acceptable than the personal, poetic Teilhard when writing in flashes of genius. And lastly, Chardin has suffered immensely at the hands of both his admirers and his usurpers. The admirers, perhaps because they admire him so much, are prone, as with any great man, to read into him their own ideas. And the usurpers, men like the communist Garrote, use him to exploit their own communist ends. Yet, I think Chardin has a message for modern man. It is a message which is not original with him. I call it, and I'm not the first one to give it this name, the vision of Chardin. 3 days before he died, Chardin wrote in his journal a short outline of what he called his thesis. Without this, and it's rather brief, I think it is impossible to make a correct appraisal of his writings. He is writing on Holy Thursday, and next to it he says, "What I believe." As found in the notes, he says he believes in three things. First, St. Paul. The three verses occurring in 1 Corinthians, chapter 15, beginning with verse 28, where the words occur, God will be all in all. And the second object of his belief, which he calls the cosmos. And here we get polysyllabic. Cosmogenesis, biogenesis, noogenesis, and Christogenesis. Those are his words. And thirdly, the two articles of my credo. One on top, one on the bottom. On top he says, and we're going to try to explain and hopefully clarify some of the language. The universe, he says, is centrated. And he adds, evolutively, upward and forward. Then the second of these two articles of my credo, Christ is its center, that is the center of this universe. Next to which he has the words, the Christian phenomenon, noogenesis and Christogenesis. With a single word, Paul, in parenthesis. So much for the context. Before we go on, we should distinguish between two things. What St. Paul was saying in the context of his letter to the Corinthians, and how Chardin interpreted Paul and extended the biblical revelation to describe what he said was his vision of the future. First Paul, then Chardin. In order to grasp St. Paul's message, it will be useful to quote the entire context in which the essential words occur, that God will be all in all. Four short statements from St. Paul. They are verses 20 to 28 in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Death came through one man, and in the same way the resurrection of the dead has come through one man. Just as all men die in Adam, so all men will be brought to life in Christ, but all of them in their proper order. Christ as the first fruits, and then after the coming of Christ, those who belong to him. After that will come the end, when he hands over the kingdom to God the Father, having done away with every sovereignty, authority, and power. For he must be king until he has put all his enemies under his feet, and the last of the enemies to be destroyed is death. For everything is to be put under his feet. Though when it is said that everything is subjected, this clearly cannot include the one who subjected everything to him. And when everything is subjected to him, then the Son himself will be subject in his turn to the one who subjected all things to him, so that God may be all in all. Unquote Paul. The Pauline message then is that Christ came into the world to undo the evil caused by Adam's fall. That is the spiritual death of which the external sign is death of the body. Through the merits of Christ, those who are saved will on the last day rise from the dead to enter with Christ into heavenly glory. God will then have achieved the goal he set for mankind. He will be acknowledged by all, and in heaven will reign in all. When this history is finished, Christ's work of redemption will have been completed. He will turn over the community of men who believed in him and give them to his Father. The process of centration in Chardin's terms, will be ended. Chardin read this passage and saw in it the summation of the whole universe. Prior to the coming of Christ, he distinguished four stages in the development of the cosmos. This is the necessary substratum to make any sense of what follows. Four stages in the development of the cosmos prior to the coming of Christ. First, from elemental matter to organized matter. Second, from organized matter to the earth. Third, from the earth as non-living to life on the earth. And, most importantly, from living things to the origin of man. With the origin of man, which Chardin calls hominization, the biological evolution is considered by Chardin to have reached its end point. From then on, the evolution that concerns him is no longer physical. How many men have misunderstood Chardin at this point? From the time that man has come on the scene, the evolution that concerns Chardin is no longer physical. That is the rise of new species. It is spiritual and social evolution. That is the production of an ever more perfect human community. In Chardin's language, this means the extension of man around the earth. Much as all life has now extended over all the earth, tending towards a harmony and unification which the gradual shrinking of the globe through communications media makes, so Chardin feels, imperative. What mankind needs, he says, is a center around which it can converge and which is able to help produce the convergence. This center, according to Chardin, is Christ. In order to clarify Chardin's thoughts, that's the best I think I can do, it may be useful to recapitulate the main points of his theory. With apologies for counting them, there are 10. The words sometimes are strange. I hope my explanation won't be more strange. First, the terms immensity and complexity. Basic to Chardin is the plea that we change our view of the universe from looking at its vastness and being awed by its bigness to looking inside it and admiring its complexity. Second, the meaning of central complexity. Some things, says Chardin, are complex only because they are complicated. But essentially, a thing is complex when it contains numerous elements, and the conjunction is crucial, and these elements are organized in a meaningful totality. The term central complexity is more expressive because it brings out the idea of an inner core of being around which or by which the complex subject is unified. Third, the hierarchy of complex things in the world. The more closely we examine the numerous things in the universe, the more impressed we become with the ascending scale of complexities which they reveal, from electron to atom to molecule to viruses to cells to plants to animals, and finally to man. We see a constantly rising central complexity which, to the eye of the scientist, is the most prominent feature of this hierarchy of being. Fourth, the evolution in terms of complexity. The key to unlocking the secrets of the universe is to recognize that not only is there a difference among beings in terms of their different complexities, but this difference reflects what has actually been happening in the eons of past time. Chardin says there are two stages of evolution traceable in past history. One pertaining to the development of more complex bodies from the less complex, and the other following the previous, in which there is a gradual deepening or intensification of consciousness. Deepening of consciousness is taken as only another, though higher, form of development of central complexity. Fifth, tangential and radial energy. Part of the language of explaining the evolution is Chardin's use of two terms to describe two different kinds of energy operating in the evolutionary process: tangential energy and radial energy. By tangential energy, he means the measurable physical energy by which material things at any level of perfection act upon and affect one another from the outside. It is the usual kind of energy that science has in mind when it speaks of matter and energy. By radial energy, he means the opposite of the first. This kind of energy is not measurable because it has no extension. It partakes of the psychic rather than the materially physical. It is present, so Chardin says, in all things. Even those commonly considered only material, and is the ultimate explanation in Chardin why things evolve towards an ever greater complexity and centrality. In other words, always forward. Sixth, and now we get into the heart of his theory. Evolution in the so-called noosphere. Chardin produced a new vocabulary. That's the least we can credit him with. Including a series of terms, all of which end in hyphen sphere. Thus, pre-biosphere, biosphere, hydrosphere, and so on. Among these, noosphere, N-O-O-sphere, is essential to an understanding of the one stage of evolution which most concerned Teilhard. Noosphere means the encircling of the earth, hence sphere, by an ever-increasing number of human beings with a mind, hence noos, from the Greek nous. The noosphere is the latest and final stage of evolution of the cosmos. When man came into being, a new world was born, the world of intelligence, freedom, and love. In a word, the noosphere. At this point, Chardin would have his reader distinguish two different phenomena: the development of the cosmos up to and including the noosphere, all the evolution through the thousands of centuries before man came on the scene, and including his arrival. He talks a lot about it, but once he has described it, he pulls the curtain. His job is finished. But then he postulates the further development of the cosmos within the noosphere since man has come on the scene. The latter is further to be distinguished according to two different forms: a biological evolution among human beings who developed because they were cohabiting in such close association on the Earth's surface. Notice, a development, a biological one, because people began to influence one another, and therefore all the evolution possible only through man's living in society. But also, and this is the crux of his theory, a spiritual evolution among these same human beings whose close proximity to one another accelerates their mutual influence and interpenetration of spirit. I might add for just a moment that he considers all the evolution prior to the arrival of man as somehow predicting or prophetic of the real evolution once man comes on the scene. Seventh stage: human evolution as collectivization. Now, the trouble with English translations is they have sometimes strange connotations. Collectivization in our language has very definite political implications. Another word for the kind of evolution Chardin sees in the human family is, to use an English word, collectivization. By this he means the slow but sure progress of people